This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Today's show is Better Storytelling, Better Aging, with Annette Simmons, author of Whoever Tells the Best Story Wins. If Paul Harvey just lectured on moral principles, he would have few listeners. But instead, millions of listeners are captivated as he tells us a story with a surprise ending and says, "And now you know the rest of the story." If Jesus had just talked about moral principles and being a good neighbor, he wouldn't have nearly as many followers as he has from including parables and stories. Tell somebody what to do, and they may become defensive or resentful. Put the same message in story form, and that message slides right in and captures the imagination. Today is about how to become a better storyteller, with particular attention to stories about aging. And it's also about becoming a better storyteller so we can step into our roles as the family matriarch or patriarch, passing down family stories, family traditions. Annette Simmons, welcome.
Well, I'm glad to be talking to you.
We like to think of ourselves as basically rational people. Why are we so pulled in by stories?
Story is actually how the human brain organizes information. Rational, the base of rational is ratio. And that was a time in our history when we noticed that some of our decisions were based so strongly in emotion that they weren't always good decisions. Frankly, there are people who got married in situations where if they would have done a pros and cons list, it would have been better. So human being purely driven by emotion is not good, but ratio-based, which is rational thinking, is a nice application to make when there is a right or a wrong answer, perhaps if it's involving money or something like that. But it's only useful when there is a right or wrong answer. Most of life is ambiguous. And stories are replications. So we can feel that, oh yeah, that's like real life. And if they guide us, which is why stories continue. Stories that don't get told more than once or twice obviously weren't very useful, weren't very engaging. But there are stories that are over 2,000 or 3,000 years old, and that there's a reason for that, because they are reliably useful in terms of being a good human being and living a good life.
If you want to know how to do things, breaking it down into smaller parts is real helpful. And one of the things you do is talk about different types of stories, starting with the Who Am I story.
Let me say that breaking it down into smaller parts is actually antithetical to story.
Whoops.
So, no, just let me have that caveat, because I made it up that there are six stories. I just want to say that up front, that there could be 60 stories, there could be only one story, but it did seem useful, and so far the response I've had with people I work with, it has been incredibly useful to start with, first, who are you, and second, why are you here? Those are the most important stories in communication, mainly because when you're trying to communicate with someone, we tend to go straight to the reasons why they should listen to us. For instance, we're trying to get someone to eat right. Maybe our kids are eating too much McDonald's and not exercising. And so we start talking about consequences of that behavior, and then we start talking about how nice the gym is, and there's some cute girls there, honey, I'm sure you'll... But that's leaping into persuasion too fast. The first thing we need to do is make sure that they understand who we are and why we're here. And sticking with the parent situation, teenagers tend to think mom is a big pain in the ass and she's here to ruin my life. And so as long as that's the story your teenager is telling him or herself about who you are, no wonder they're not listening. But if you can tell a story about when you were a teenager and a very real, authentic story, not a patronizing, you know, when I was a kid, I worked out every day or I was on the swim team, but something that holds that I was both a good kid and a rotten kid, or I was both happy and sad, I was both secure and insecure. That connects them with you, because when you say who I am, they really begin to feel connected. And to use a metaphor from technology, now you've got some bandwidth across which you can communicate. When you explain who you are and why you're here, that builds a bridge, and then you can start sending your information about whatever you want to persuade them to do or to refrain from doing.
And that kind of gets into the Paul Harvey part, in that if the parent just says the obvious, it's not going to be a very effective story. If there's something revealing or something that really hooks their curiosity, then you're going to have a more captivated listener and you're going to have more credibility.
And the reason that works is because if you state the obvious, what you're doing is you're presenting this person with your conclusions. And when you tell a story, see, experience is the best teacher. We all know that. But what is kind of hidden is that story is actually second best, because story is a simulated experience. And the Paul Harvey effect is that the story takes you through the situation where you actually don't know what's coming, and you are experiencing suspense is something that mimics real life. During suspense, what you're actually feeling is impatience. And then when you find out what happens next, you come to your own conclusions. And whoever's listening to you when you're telling the story, they come to their own conclusions. And instead of you giving them your conclusions, when they come to their own conclusions, they value their conclusions a lot more than they value yours.
And on these Who Am I stories, you probably deal with them most in the context of business, since that's where you do a lot of your training. Who is this consultant or who is this speaker? But I was thinking about aging, and people get a divorce or they become widows or widowers, and they're out on that first date, and the person that they have the date with is dying of curiosity. Well, who is this person? And if you just say, well, I'm an engineer, I was born in Toledo, and that kind of thing, that's not going to captivate them. But if you have this great backstory with the twists and the turns, that's really going to capture their imagination.
Absolutely. And one of the things that's really cool about that is it helps you also get to know them. When I was in my early 20s, gotten engaged in 7 days, I really believe in getting to know someone slowly. It makes the marriage last, I'm sure, much longer than mine did. So when you tell little stories, each little story is a hologram of everything you are and everything that you're not. So if I tell a little story about my first pet, it starts a conversation where that person is probably going to tell me a story about their first pet. For instance, my first pet was a dog that my daddy brought home as a hunting dog, and then he brought another kind of fluffy dog home for me to play with. And when he took Patch, was his name, out hunting, the minute he shot his gun, Patch was gone. And after looking for him for about 2 hours, finally Dad decided to come home. And as he got in the car and drove off to come home, he looked in the rearview mirror, and there was Patch. He was hiding under the car the whole time. So you tell me about your first pet.
Yeah, it always amazed me that you haven't seen somebody in years. You go to meet them at the airport, and the usual sequence is you, how was your flight, talk about the weather and that kind of thing, and you just gradually wade into more and more intimate conversations. But what you're saying is you can cut right to something much more meaningful. You've got a choice. You can talk about the weather and then you go home and all you know is what they thought of the weather. Or you can talk about the pets or first dates or whatever and get a much meatier idea of who the person was.
Absolutely.
And it's not just dates, it's job interviews or just...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And the thing is that when you tell a story, you get a story. When I would be interviewing someone, I would do that first, is I would go ahead and start the ball rolling by telling a story. And then it's a quid pro quo. It's the dance of communication and getting to know each other.
Think about the job interviews you've had. How many of them involved either party telling stories? It's rare.
Well, you would be surprised. And working with the large global organizations, it has become a formal part of interviews because they understand how powerful it is. It may not have trickled down, but again, it may have. You would be surprised. Tell me a story about a time when you failed. It's just about integrated into the network of business communication now, where at least in performance reviews and hiring situations, story is one of the bedrocks of the way to communicate.
So rather than being fluff, this is a competitive advantage or disadvantage.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Whether you've given some thought and even practice to telling stories.
Yeah. It's where your believability comes from. You can't exactly sit in there and say, my name is Annette, and one of the things about me is that I'm trustworthy and I have integrity. But I could tell a time about when I was really tested, and it would have been a lot easier to just rationalize away an agreement, and yet I kept that agreement anyway. A lot of people think that they can't tell that story because it's bragging. The thing is, if you're bragging, people can hear it in your voice, and they get turned off. It doesn't matter. If you're not bragging and you tell the story, people know you're not bragging because they can hear it in your voice. If you're just sharing the information knowing that you're no better or no worse than anybody else, telling a story about when you kept your agreements with the assumption that anybody would do the same, then you don't risk sounding arrogant.
So stories have become very common in business. Is my impression correct that in politics, most of the politicians haven't really caught on to it and just say, trust me, and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that for you?
I have to turn the mute button on when politicians come on the TV. It truly is painful. I have seen during debates, televised debates, examples where I could tell that the politician had been coached to tell a story, but they didn't know how to tell a story. One of the mistakes I have seen made is that they tell a story about someone they've never met. They have this generic, the Smith family who pays such and such in taxes. A story isn't real unless you actually went to the Smith family's house and sat on their couch and talked with them, and then it just flows. So authenticity is one of the things that makes stories work.
So when you're thinking about what stories can I tell, the starting place is your own personal experience, and if that doesn't do it, then who do I know, like friends and family? And if you have to, you can resort to movies and books and literature and things like that.
Let's just say, what's the purpose of your story? I'm dealing with teenagers right now. You get many opportunities to be frustrated with a lack of communication. So the purpose of communication lately has been, how do I get this kid to pay more attention to Algebra 2? And sometimes it's about getting them connected with a friend I know who works at NASA. And yet, I'll tell a story about us in college, me and my friend who works at NASA, to make this person sound really cool, which they are. When we were doing something silly with dry ice, we went into the professor's office and when he wasn't looking, put a piece of dry ice in his coffee, so that by the time he turned around, the smoke was curling out of his coffee cup and across the table, and he did a little bit of a freak out, which we thought was hilarious. Anyway, the teenager connects with that, and now he's more interested in science, even though my story didn't actually have to do. Do you see how that works?
Mm-hmm.
So you really can just worry about making one connection to the next level, to the next level, to the next level. And I trust people. If it comes in your head, it's probably going to be a good idea. You can steal a scene from Shrek, or you can tell a story about somebody else who some of your listeners may have athletes that they admire. And, for instance, I like yoga, so I've studied with Rodney Yee, and I tell some stories about studying with him. Any of those kinds of stories.
So you're human just like them, and you have heroes just like them, and the brush with greatness feeling, and they're going to be interested in, well, what did you get from this hero?
Well, you hope they're going to be interested. Storytelling is something that you co-create in the moment, and you're watching their eyes, and hopefully they're watching yours. And if their eyes start to glass over, you really need to change the subject or speed it up. When I teach people how to tell stories, I recommend a 3-minute story. Now, that's in the business environment, but in any environment, definitely if you start this out, brevity is a gift. No one will ever get irritated with you because your story was too short. They may ask you to tell them more, which is a nice thing to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But the worst thing to happen is to have them start shifting their eyes looking for a way out of the room. And that's a danger. Maybe 30 to 50% of people can find that they start and they can't stop.
So what do they need to do besides watching people's eyes? Just practice?
Well, if you're in a business environment, you would definitely practice. And the way you would practice is you would find someone who is a friendly listener, somebody who wants you to succeed, because storytelling, unless you're a professional storyteller for about 10 or 15 years, you never want to get somebody to give you a critique. Our culture is so inundated with the concept that if you get a critique, if you get feedback, and I'm using quotation marks with my little fingers, that you'll get better. But in the creative arts, particularly with storytelling, it's a little baby story, and it's too soon to prune. So if you are going to practice a story, it's very important to practice with someone who you have an agreement with, that they'll tell you what they like about the story, and that's it. And then, of course, the time frame, a 3-minute time frame.
Now, I've personally found a story that I'm really, really working on, like one for a speech, it can be very helpful having a very skilled person give a critique and suggestions. But you're saying that's advanced stuff and really kills the baby if you do it too soon.
Yeah. And I would also say that you may be surprised if you would try another coach for a story from scratch. With only appreciations, you might be surprised what you come out with, because I've been using my coach, Doug Lipman, for 15 years, and it really works. It's amazing how when someone says, I don't think you should talk about blah, 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 because people get distracted, it's amazing how that can actually chop up your story, because you tend to focus on not saying that. Whereas appreciations, you just blossom out the pieces that work, and the rest of the stuff gets squeezed out. It's very counterintuitive, particularly for our culture, but I've seen it work over and over.
I guess most of the feedback I've gotten wasn't the knots, but more of embellish this and do even more and encouragement to
then those are appreciations
to go all out.
Yeah.
Are there other things that people can do to get better at storytelling?
Well, I'm interested in why they want to get better at storytelling, because ultimately you're talking about people living longer, healthier, happier lives. And that's a particular kind of storytelling, which means it's the story I tell myself. And so getting better at the story I tell myself about who I am and why I'm here is a different kind of storytelling than perhaps a businessman. The business people, the first thing I say when they want to know how they can get better at storytelling, I want to share with them the story of King Midas. I don't know how old that story is, but when they're that old, they have some big T-truth in them. And King Midas prayed that everything he touched would turn to gold, and he got his wish. So he was just so happy, everything he touched had turned to gold, and his little girl ran up to him, and he went to pick her up, and she turned into a statue of gold. And so his wish turned his daughter into gold. He killed his baby girl. You know, watch what you wish for is a simple way to look at that, but it also, for me, points out that 100% influence creates 100% isolation. And so storytelling is about influencing and being influenced. So I never look at storytelling as anything other than 50% of telling stories and 50% finding or gathering people's stories, looking for adventures even. Those two categories right there are just the beginning of answering that big question you just asked, which is how does somebody become a better storyteller?
So it's a dance.
Yeah, I think so.
We're talking with Annette Simmons, author of Whoever Tells the Best Story Wins, actually author of several books, including The Story Factor and Territorial Games. Annette, what's the difference between Whoever Tells the Best Story Wins and The Story Factor?
The Story Factor is my first book on storytelling and by far the most successful. It's a comprehensive guide to why storytelling works and the different ways that you can apply storytelling. Whoever Tells the Best Story Wins is a book I wrote when I realized that I can't travel everywhere, and I don't want to travel everywhere, speaking of aging. So I wanted to create a book that was a workshop, a workbook that people can buy. They don't ever have to come to a workshop I teach. They can just work through the book. And it has the six stories and then four different places you can look for a story. And so I give examples of all those. If you do the book, you end up with 24 stories to tell in 24 different situations.
So it walks you through saying, stop and construct your story now and write it down before moving on.
And here's where to look for a story. The hardest part is, I know I need a story that's going to do this. And I see this all the time. People say, but I don't have any stories. And, you know, it's just like, well, did you ever fall in love? Were you ever dumped? Did you have an argument with your spouse? Did you ever have to ask for forgiveness? Any of those, what I call universal human experiences, all of us have had those experiences, and every single time in the past that experience has happened, that's a story. Now, whether you choose to tell it or not, okay, but they're all fruitful sources for telling a story.
And then what is Territorial Games?
Territorial Games was the first book I wrote, and I was working internationally, and I saw that groups sometimes started to bleed IQ points instead of coming up with fast decisions that were implemented immediately. There would be infighting, and I was frustrated and decided to do some research. And so when I asked people to tell me what happened, they would give me metaphors, like the guy's a backstabber, or it was just a pissing contest, and thank goodness that's a metaphor. But when I asked them, well, actually, that didn't happen, what happened, then they would tell me stories. And those stories began to reveal that there are tiny micro-behaviors people display. And this is in business or volunteer groups or families even, that show someone they're out or create an in-group. And these micro-behaviors started to repeat themselves. So I used the model of transactional analysis and just came up with the 10 territorial games. So once you see them, it's kind of hard to pretend like you're not doing it. One of them is strategic noncompliance, which is you're in a meeting and you go, sure, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And you're thinking, when hell freezes over. These are some patterns that repeat themselves, that deteriorate, that it's just being territorial.
And transactional analysis is the Eric Byrne, the I'm okay, you're okay. It brings back a lot of memories.
Yeah, I know. It was a long time ago. I actually learned that when I was like 15 or 16 years old because my parents had gotten divorced. And my daddy, who was a probation officer, federal probation officer, didn't know what to do with me after school on Tuesdays. And before we went to my grandmother's house at 6 o'clock for dinner. And so those 3 hours, he had been at, you know, weekend workshops learning how to be a social worker. And in my junior and senior year, he taught me transactional analysis. He taught me rational emotive therapy, which is Albert Ellis, and he also, because it was the 70s, taught me transcendental meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a strange teenager anyway. He really ramped it up.
Oh, those were very popular at the time. It wasn't that strange. The website is groupprocessconsulting.com. That's groupprocessconsulting.com, and it talks about your training and speaking and books and a lot of other information. A few minutes ago, we were talking about business stories, and I was thinking about what are the stories that are particularly applicable to aging. And the more I thought about it, the more one of the things came to me is that a lot of it's about dealing with life transitions. Why did I get cancer? Why did I get a heart attack? Why did I get fired or, as you said, dumped or divorced or whatever? What am I going to do with retirement? Coming up with those kind of stories.
The facts are whatever they are, and you can't change those. But the story you wrap around those facts changes everything. It certainly changes the primary emotion you feel whenever you think about those facts. And I think from my personal experience that I go through stages. Personally, I have to let myself have a little bit of a pity party. Why me? I stomp my feet and I eat worms and nobody loves me.
That's Southern, but okay.
Huh?
I said that's Southern.
Yeah, okay. Well, after, you know, and I always want to validate that people have that. Barbara Ehrenreich just wrote a book called Bright-Sided. Are you familiar with that?
No.
Well, she had breast cancer, and Barbara Ehrenreich is a social anthropologist. I mean, she's an incredible writer and researcher, having written the book Nickel and Dime.
Mm-hmm.
You heard of that one?
I remember the reviews on that.
So with breast cancer, her frustration was that everybody was so cheerful and perky, and she just wanted to punch them in the face. I can really relate to that because positive thinking, 100% of the time, feels like a denial to me. And it is a very superficial story. Everything's going to be fine. Ha, ha, ha. One of the things I like in the stories that I look for is some complexity. When I look at historical figures or look at biographies, understanding how other people have dealt with tragedy gives me creative ideas. And it's not just helps me deal with it, but using someone else's life as an analogy can give me creative ideas. Katharine Graham's autobiography, she ran the Washington Post for I don't know how long. Madeleine Albright's autobiography. Queen Latifah, she wrote an autobiography, or memoir, really.
Mm-hmm.
Those type of stories I can get into, even some of the novels, and then you overlay that into your circumstances, and you can choose to look at this situation as an obstacle, and yet the part you're going to play is either the adventurer or perhaps the heretic, or there are different roles and characters you can play in this journey. It turns it around to where you're in control, which is something I've always liked to be in control. Actually, happiness is, being in control is one of the most important things, or perception of being in control, to people's self-reported levels of happiness. Did you know that?
I'm going to have to think about that, because when I look at the Sonia Lyubomirsky's research and that kind of thing, I don't see them, the major researchers, talking about control. People really want it, but I don't know that it's an element of happiness. Perhaps it's just the opposite, that not desperately trying to be in control may make you happier.
Well, desperately trying to be in control is very different than having control over your own environment. What I'm trying to say is that if you feel like you're a victim,
mm-hmm,
and that you have no control, then that's what makes us sick. And you can, I'm sure you and I have, and your listeners have seen people walking around with as many hours in their day as everybody else, a car to drive, and yet they say that, well, I can't because, and yes, but, and that's the kind of control I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The perception of having control over your own life, so that desperately trying to control everything. I understand what you're saying right there. Being a control freak is certainly not the path to happiness.
Or a lot of anxiety comes from trying to control things that we can't control.
Right, right. And I'm not disagreeing with that. But what I am talking about is my story can help me feel like I am not the victim, which is at least being in control of how I react.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm saying about your story.
Now, ideally, what you're describing is almost like therapy, in that you look at the situation, whether it's your own life or friends, spouses, colleagues, and you say, well, what do they need at this point? Their wife just died. What can I say to them beyond my sympathies? And you're kind of catching what does he need to hear at this point, and then delivering that kind of a story.
I haven't thought about that. Tell me more. I don't understand what you're saying.
That at different times we're needing different things, and you were talking earlier about you look into the person's eyes and you've got that dance going. I'm saying oftentimes before you even start the story, you get a sense of what does this person really need emotionally at this point in their life, or in terms of guidance at this point in their life, and that's the story that you choose to tell. It's rather than, well, what's my best story?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah, because storytelling, one of the most important principles, and in my book I have 6 principles, but one of the most important principles is that it's, at that moment, it's not for you, it's for them, it's a gift you're giving. And there are people who tell stories just to get attention or to sound important, or frankly, there's a whole lot of people who tell stories so that they can vent anger. I usually start out with, let me tell you something, or you know what happened today? And those people are telling stories for their own benefit. And I'm not dissing that. Everybody needs to have somebody listen to them And if you don't have somebody listening to you, go find a therapist. And I believe in therapy, and I've always been a consumer. You need somebody to listen to your stories where it's for you, time for you to tell your stories and get listened to. But when you're telling a story as a gift to somebody, I think one of the best things that you can do is clean out, kind of comb it free of your needs, so that it really does have the capacity to be there as a gift for them.
And it's interesting, therapy in some ways is kind of the opposite, in that the person tells their story and the therapist subtly comes back, often without the person really realizing what's happening, and recasts that story in a more helpful or a more positive way, or tells another story that moves them in the direction that they need to go.
A lot of people do therapy that way. Absolutely.
We'll get back to Annette Simmons in just a moment. This message is for mental health professionals who need continuing education credits. I recently did a major update of my 3-hour and 10-hour CE courses for the Zur Institute. The 10-hour course is a combination of healthy aging research and interviews with cutting-edge anti-aging professionals. Psychologists, social workers, nurses, counselors, and marriage and family counselors, why spend the travel time, travel money, and time away from work to go to conferences when you can get excellent courses and CE credits online in the convenience of your home? To get credit for my CE courses on aging and positive psychology, just go to zurinstitute.com. That's zurinstitute.com. The Zur Institute also has more than 100 other online professional courses. That's zurinstitute.com. And now back to Annette Simmons. When you were talking about telling stories about people, some of the aging ones that come to mind is, if I'm talking with a woman who I want to encourage to be more outrageous, I might talk about Maggie Kuhn, or I might talk about the Red Hat Society. If I'm talking to somebody, particularly a man who recently retired and he's bored to death and just desperately needs a challenge, I might talk about how Colonel Sanders got his first Social Security check and said, boy, this sucks, and went out and started hawking his chicken recipe. It's again, looking for that fit of who's the role model that they need.
Absolutely. Or
if it's a story for yourself, who's the role model that I need?
As I work, I get to hear all these wonderful stories. So I fly into some place, large groups of people. I do workshops. Sometimes it's just a keynote. That's not as much fun because I don't get to hear everybody's stories. But recently I was in Colorado, and there's about 60 people in the room, so I got to hear lots of stories. And one of the stories, and I get a lot of these stories on a regular basis, is a story about how in someone's youth, somebody spent like 5 minutes with them, and that really changed the trajectory of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that that can happen again. There's no reason why that can't happen again. When you pay attention and look and see what might spark interest, I don't teach leadership specifically as much anymore, but I had a client that I was going to facilitate dialogue, which is my second book, A Safe Place for Dangerous Truth. I thought we could all tell the truth in a room. Yeah, right. But anyway, I still do it. I'm not quite as hard on people as I let them choose the level of truth. Anyway, the leader of this group was just getting walked all over because he was, you can use the word, too nice. He was passive, and I didn't want to insult him, but I was asking him to look at these situations, and finally it occurred to me to say, well, think of a character, someone that you know, someone that would just, there's no way that anyone would walk all over him. And the first thing he said was Dick Cheney. And I was like, well, okay, perhaps somebody else. Because I'm thinking, I don't want him to turn into Dick Cheney. not certain. It was in the healthcare industry. Mm-hmm. He's running a children's center. And then he came up with Harry Truman.
Mm-hmm.
And so he checked out the book of Harry Truman's life, a biography, and started reading it. And as we worked together, he started to work in some of Harry Truman-isms into his leadership style. And it was remarkable, the change. And it's really kind of a fast track to change, to look at some role model and then and borrow their life for a little while until you get started on your own.
And also the five-minute story that changed my life, or five-minute experience that changed my life, is also a meta-message or meta-story about change can happen just that quickly and can weave in, and it can happen at any age.
I think so.
I was looking at categories of stories, and one of the categories is teaching stories, and I thought I'd give an example of a teaching story.
Good.
If I just talk to people about how you want to feel younger than your age, it can sound very sophomoric and nice pop psychology stuff, and it often rolls right off people. I did a consult once because the gentleman wasn't eating and he wasn't taking his medicine. And I found him to be just a delightful man, and he told me he was 64 years old. Well, I knew from his chart that he was 94. So I said, well, when were you born? And he said, 1911. And I said, do you remember the Great Depression? He says, oh, yeah, I was a senior in high school, and that was really rough times. So I took out a piece of paper, and I wrote 2005 minus 1911. And I said, can you do this math problem? He said, I think so. And he took the pencil and wrote 94. And he said, 94, that's not right, because I'm 64. Every bone in this man's body believed that he was 64. So I was thinking in the back of my head, is it my job as a psychologist to try to get him in touch with reality that he's 94?
Oh, dear.
Or is he better off thinking he's 64?
Right.
And then I, you know, just leave people to wrestle with that question themselves, and 99% of the time they're going to say he's better off thinking he's 64.
Yeah. Yeah. I would, that's where I would come out on that question.
So that would be a teaching story.
Absolutely. It's great. It's a great teaching story.
Do you have a favorite story?
Oh, I have tons of favorite stories. It's embarrassing because in my private life, people will ask me a simple question. They'll say, oh, I like that ring. And then I will launch into a story about everything. So to ask favorite story today, I've been invited to be a guest lecturer for an honors program at university. And in looking at the history of story and my history of understanding story, one of our national treasures was a storyteller named Ray Hicks. And he was one of the first storytellers at the National Storytelling Festival in Tennessee. By the way, if any listeners want to investigate storytelling and feel young and have a good time, go to the National Storytelling Festival the first weekend of October in Jonesboro, Tennessee. It's just a great weekend. And don't take the kids, because it's so not for kids. Not that it's adult content. It's just it's for us adults. It's wonderful. He was always there. And his stories, because he learned from his great-granddaddy, were stories that actually had the roots in old English stories, like from Chaucer's time. And he delivered them with this kind of old English. His southern Appalachian accent had old English words in there, if you listened. He lived in a cabin and without running water. He was 6'4", and he had a overalls, one flap was always undone, He always had a little bit of a, he didn't have a chin. He always said, I look like a crane. From his bottom lip goes straight to his neck. There really wasn't anything there. And skinny, and he told so many stories, and I sat on his porch and listened with him. But when I went to leave, he said, now, Annette, I need you to go out there and you know, there's, we got to up the numbers. And he talked like this in kind of fragments. He said, you know, when I was a kid, I was about, you know, 16. I was walking out, there used to be a road, path now. It's a road out near the mountain. It's got a hang off there. And I was just walking out there, and I swear, you know, it was quiet, and it's about noontime, and you could hear the birds and everything. And then all of a sudden, I felt a slap between my shoulder blades, and the very devil jumped on my back, and I was looking off the side of the cliff there, and that devil just told me, why don't you just go ahead and jump? Why don't you go ahead and end it all? Just jump. Just get it over with now. Now, his father had committed suicide. He had hung himself. So, you know, this is a pretty scary story. And he said, that devil whispered in my ear real fast. Tell me, just go ahead and get it done. Get it done. Do it. Do it now. He goes, I dropped to my knees, and I started praying, Lord God, take this devil from my back. And that devil voice just fast telling me, just go ahead and jump. Get it over with. You ain't no good. Nobody wants you. Get it done. And I was praying, and all of a sudden I heard a different voice. And the voice I heard was a calm, peaceful voice. And that peaceful voice, it told me, Ray, you don't have to do that. That's how Ray talked.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell it any other way. And he said, and that devil voice, it was gone. It was gone. And then he looked at me and says, now, Annette, I think people out there today, they might be listening to the wrong voice. So you need to go out there and tell them. It's going to be okay. So that's my favorite story for right now.
I've been thinking a lot about Ray. Thank you. We've been talking with Annette Simmons. If you want to really put your own stories together, I highly recommend Whoever Tells the Best Story Wins. Or if you want to learn about stories in general, The Story Factor is excellent. The website is groupprocessconsulting.com. That's groupprocessconsulting.com. Annette, absolutely fascinating, and I thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and I hope that people have a lot of fun with stories and they make lots of warmer connections with the people around them, because that's what makes life at least happier and a lot more fun.
One of my themes is that we can get better with age, and one of the things we tend to get better at is telling better stories.
Yeah, yeah, and listening.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, I'm much better listening than I was even 5 years ago, and 1,000 times better than I was in my 20s.
See, it gets better and better.
Yeah.
Commentary. Dr. Mehmet Oz says, by the time we're 50, two-thirds of how we age will be determined by our lifestyle. The goal of Ageless Lifestyles is to help people live longer, healthier, happier lives. One of the biggest challenges with aging is reinventing a sense of purpose and contribution as we age. I know it may sound strange, but I believe becoming a better storyteller is very helpful with longevity, health, and happiness. Let me count the ways. By helping you be more successful at communicating your ideas and influencing people, you are better able to follow your purpose and succeed at your goals. Becoming a better storyteller promotes you to a family matriarch or patriarch, championing the family values and traditions that you love in a way that captures the minds and hearts of family members of all ages. Storytelling develops a sense of confidence and efficacy, and it's fun. So, what did Annette Simmons teach us about storytelling? Well, it is easy to think, I would like to be a good storyteller, but I don't have any stories. She points out, we all have had life crises, challenges, life transitions, and thus we all have stories. How do you find them? She breaks it into six kinds of stories. Who am I? Why am I here? Teaching stories, vision stories, values and action stories, and I know what you're thinking stories. Well, some storytellers have different classifications. Annette Simmons' system is especially well-suited for everyday living, thinking about aging, as well as business. Let's focus on aging. The Who Am I stories are especially important as we update our identity when we experience life transitions and health challenges. It can vary from the somewhat negative, why me, to the more positive, what now? Life transitions and challenges also prompt why am I here stories to update our purpose. Teaching stories are especially important for how we view aging. An example is the story I told about the 94-year-old man who believed he was 64. Vision stories get us to look at the big picture and purpose. Values and action stories are particularly important in aging for making sure people don't write off seniors as obsolete and irrelevant, but view seniors as having a lot to contribute. Finally, I know what you're thinking stories are marvelous for acknowledging skepticism and differences, starting where the listener is, and leading them to considering possibilities that they usually would rule out. So how do you become a better storyteller? The starting point is believing that you have stories to tell and looking for them. I find it helpful to write down stories soon after they happen, as it's easy to forget the details that add so much to the richness of a story. Annette Simmons says, whoever tells the best story wins, is very helpful in identifying and generating stories. She encourages us to tell the stories to supportive audiences who give feedback on what they liked. Then it's a question of practice, 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 and carefully watching the responses you get. You are listening to Ageless Lifestyles on webtalkradio.net and permanently archived on agelesslifestyles.com. For information on my books, Defy Aging and 52 Baby Steps to Grow Young, anti-aging hypnosis CDs, personal coaching, and keynote and seminar services, just go to notaging.com or drbricky.com, drbricky.com. I'd love to hear your comments and suggestions. Send them to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. This is your anti-aging psychologist, Dr. Michael Bricky, thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.